Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Lockdown Toronto. I really appreciate you tuning back in. Last week, we were offline for blackout reasons, for obvious reasons, and this week we're back again, and I hope you enjoy the episode. The episode today has to deal with a super important subject near and dear to my heart. It is democracy, and how does governance happen within the framework of democracy during a pandemic? Obviously, there's technologies that enable people to talk to each other, but how does the process of public input happen? How do people, there's lots of condos going up around the city, and they all involve statutory public meetings. How does that happen? What happens when, you know, the technicals of meeting people during committees or during council tend to interrupt the natural flow of debate and dialogue? And today I bring on a very special guest who can speak directly to a lot of these issues and more. And her name is Shelley Carroll. She is a city councillor for Don Valley North, Ward 17. And I've known her for many years. I really appreciate her input. She's super insightful, super sharp, super witty. And she's going to be a great guest. And you can hear her chuckling in the background, so I might as well just throw it to Shelley right now. Welcome, Councillor Carroll, to the cast. Really appreciate you coming on. It's been a while, so I really appreciate you coming on the show. I couldn't think of a better guest to bring on in this certain framework of conversation, just because you are very sharp when it comes to a lot of these issues. How's City Hall been since the reduction of the wards, for example? Has the workload been great? Has it been manageable and pre-pandemic, let's put it that way?
Well, I'll tell you, the workload in terms of just addressing what's happening with your ward really is huge now. You have no idea what the difference in geography makes at this level of government, because, you know, as you know, the services we deliver are granular. It's everything from did my garbage get picked up on time, all the way up to, you know, the crisis that is going on in the community around police and race. And so you run the gamut, and you have to deal with all issues large and small. And so the workload is hugely increased. But we can't whine about that, because we took a very swift measure right off the bat. We knew boundaries may change, but nobody asked for their services to change. And so what we did was take the council staff that were working for 44 councillors and distribute that budget amongst the 25. So basically, the amount of neighborhoods each of my staff members covers in terms of service is about the same as it was before. I just have a larger team of staff. And so people are getting that response. But in terms of the workload in policy sense, in committee and council sense, it's actually too light.
Really?
Too much is done very superficially and very hurriedly. For some reason, we have decided to help make good on the Premier's province promise that council sessions would be smaller, especially in Toronto, if he put in place his changes. And so we rush now through issues of real importance. And you want to say, hold on, can we have a second round? This is a massive change. And we just go on anyway. Even right now, responding to COVID, in our last council session, we were dealing with the economic recovery that will be part of re-enter and reopen, right, and the virus itself and how we're dealing with the disease. And a motion passed with much more than a blink. We passed a motion that we combine those two, and people would have one opportunity to question and one opportunity to speak on these two giant issues in everyone's life.
That's incredible.
And that's sort of the fervor of there's only 25 of us. We have to prove we can have fast council sessions. It was
Hold
shocking.
On a second. Why did you have to prove that you can have fast council sessions when
fought a good fight?
The court case is working its way through the Supreme Court in order to fight the provincial order for 25 wards. Why is council bending over backwards to prove that the province was right when council or when the city is also going to court to prove that it's wrong?
Well, you know, the theme of this particular council and this administration is it's bipolar.
Okay.
It's full on bipolar.
Yeah, schizophrenic,
we
right?
We can't get along with our premier, but we're always trying to please him.
I'm not even going to get into that because I could probably talk for 3 hours on that issue. I've got lots to say, and I'm sure you do too, but our time is limited, so I want to use it efficiently. Okay, fast forward to the whole COVID thing. So setting aside the community meetings and stuff, already there was a demand for your face to be at more community meetings, likely on the ground, and maybe the workload at the council has been light, so now you have to send staffers instead of making an appearance. Suddenly the pandemic hits, and now all council sessions have to happen through online measures. And I just, the other day, I clicked on, just randomly, at a position in the council YouTube feed, and it was literally you yelling over top of Councillor Pasternak, who was trying to come through on a feed. And then Councillor Karagiannis was yelling at you because he thought you were controlling the session. And then staff were kind of chiming in saying that they could hear it, but other people couldn't. And I'm like, this, if there's anything that underscores that council is quote unquote dysfunctional, which is never has been, there's no better opportunity to highlight that than now add in a layer of technology that has a 2.3 second delay with different Wi-Fi regimes around the council spaces, and everyone's just tripping over each other. Is that a common thing? Has it been very disruptive in terms of debate and discussion during the meetings?
Well, you picked a perfect example of what we lose when we have a virtual meeting. The role that I was performing there is one that I was actually discussed with clerks. I'm the alternate speaker.
Oh, nice.
And so I go down to City Hall for the meetings, and I'm in another room. Francis Nunziata, the speaker, sits in a room with just the core of the people you used to see, the big crowd around the center table. Mm-hmm. Just some of them are in that room with her now. And they are constantly trying to give her feedback about what's coming in, because we now text that we want to speak, or we have a point of order. So there's several information points coming in, and there's so much more information being fed to Francis on pieces of paper. They said, just keep an eye on things, be an extra set of ears, because there are going to be lots of times when she does not hear what's going on. And so I'm doing that. If we were in a council chamber, the fact that that's my role would be clear to the people sitting in that room, but they're not. They're all at home. They're all over the city of Toronto. So when I jump in to say, Madam Speaker, James can't hear you, she says, who's yelling at me? What's going on? And James starts, and someone else says, why is Councillor Carroll speaking at all?
Right.
The reminder that I'm the alternate speaker and I'm doing what I'm supposed to do isn't there for them visually anymore. And that happened in different little bust ups in all sorts of ways all through the day. There was even a point where the media made much of this. They put a photograph of it out where Councillor Karagiannis has a tendency to forget his mute button. And he started talking to someone on the phone who sounded a lot like he was talking to a lobbyist between you and
no
me.
No
way. We don't know. But everyone started to scream, and we forget at that moment that we're also on camera in much greater close-up than we're used to.
Right.
So there's all these people doing, oh my God, and face-palming. that was all captured, of course, in a screenshot.
That's
and
beautiful.
Appeared in the Toronto Star. So in that moment, it feels like you have more transparency in government.
But people keep tripping up online.
So much. Yeah. But so much of the back and forth and discussion and who you're really taking on if you make a speech, because you're standing and you're looking at them.
Mm-hmm.
So the dynamic has disappeared. And that, I think, takes away transparency, takes away democracy, and any sense of engagement with the community is gone, because there is no gallery anymore.
True.
No eyes there to hold us to account.
And I can imagine that when the motion to defund police, which is coming to council next session, you know, you'd have a gallery full of people in support of, or even in non-support of the motion. And you would typically have, for those at home, you know, the council chamber is a clamshell shaped and the councilors sit inside, but all around is a wall of people that can potentially sit behind and support. Obviously they have to stay, they can't yell out. It can't be like a crowd, although that's happened. But at the end of the day, you know, certain legislative measures, certain motions, certain initiatives, they gain energy from that. And people can go into the audience and the gallery and discuss the issue with people and help people see eye to eye. And like that is that I imagine is completely lost. And it takes a huge a foot off the standing of effective governance. And although, I mean, like what you described earlier with Councillor Karygiannis talking to lobbyists, or quote unquote, maybe he wasn't, but,
allegedly.
Yeah. Allegedly. That might offer a counter example of increased transparency. Although I remember someone describing it online when they had to engage with the federal government on an issue and they were an expert. They said it was a meeting designed by Christopher Guest. That's what it seemed like. But moving on, so that's on the council level. I mean, obviously the technology and the disruptions probably have a temporary status, right? Because at the end of the day, council will eventually come back into its normal rhythm of things once maybe a vaccine is found, maybe extra testing's done or an effective treatment is done that makes the risk virtually low. I'm not sure if you have anything to say on that, but...
Well, we might not wait that long. We might not wait that long. We're already nervous about the length of this state of emergency where the mayor has ultimate authority, and he's nervous about it himself. He consults because he's nervous about it, but, you know, it's becoming too much of regular business. So we actually moved a motion in the last council session for clerks to begin preparing a way for us to, with distancing, meet in person in a chamber and as soon as possible for committees as well, because we don't want to keep the public shut out for too much longer. And also, we know we're losing something by not being there in person. And so we didn't want to wait and then have a debate, should we or shouldn't we? We just moved a motion and gave authority to the clerks to, as soon as you know that it is medically safe, our next meeting can be public, and we've given you the directive to go ahead and design that.
Yeah.
And so they're working on that now.
That's encouraging, because I can't imagine council can, well, at least the public, you tend to lose credibility or authority behind certain issues if the public hasn't had an effective way to chime in. And I want to actually throw that down to the community level.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm watching, you know, the development initiative behind Downsview Park, which is 600 acres of prime real estate, basically being thrown to a webinar. Like, and you got private developers pushing for online engagement on these very important issues where they can, one, completely ignore people. I mean, the upside is there might be a public record for people who are voicing their concerns, but nothing can replace the yelly community meetings, which tend to happen around bad developments, right? I mean, that tends to scare people straight, scare developers straight, and help developers understand that they can't just steamroll over a community. And that's always been the case with the Downsview Park development, but it seems like they are using this pandemic as a prime opportunity to shove maybe unwanted development, is a fair term, unwanted development on a community through expediting this process for online session under the fig leaf that it's just because of the pandemic. Meanwhile, they could sure as hell wait a long time to get this through. As chair, or not chair, but as a member of North York Community Council, how do you feel about that specific project as a kind of microcosm example of what might be going on around the city?
It's a perfect example. I've got some in my own ward, but if you think of Downsview, because it's known citywide, it's a perfect example, because what they are probably doing, the development community, is likely very similar to what was happening around the time of the global financial crisis. If something was in application, while people are otherwise engaged in the crisis of their lives, there was this frantic rush. Please, please, please consider my application. Oh, we just have to get this done. You have to do my approval before the election. You may recall that while the crisis happened in 2008, 2009 was the tough year, and then we were in election year in 2010. Developers went crazy saying, I got to get my approval, I got to get my approval. They had every intention of waiting out the financial crisis. And so they got all these approvals done in record time, thinking, okay, that'll be economic stimulus if they build. The reality is once the approval's in place, done at a time when fewer people are likely to pay any attention to the statutory public meetings that are necessary, then no one comes to pick up the permit to begin construction until the market has recovered.
Wow.
That's going to happen only more so this time. What will happen is, while it's virtual meeting time, please, 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 we have to proceed. Let's have a virtual community council. Please, can I be on that agenda? The construction might not happen for 5 years.
And
they want the meeting to happen now.
Yeah, and I guess it doesn't help that the mayor's former chief of staff is spearheading part of that effort, which is not a good look. But what about staff? I mean, the North York planning staff, are they buying just the argument of the developers in the sense where they feel like they need to throw this through in order to spur economic development? Or is it just a matter of them trying to, I can't wrap my head around it, but is there not a directive that council can give to staff to pump the brakes on, you know, community meetings that are happening virtually versus the ones that should be happening in person?
Well, the inability to have a proper community meeting is currently still kind of slowing things down. We've had one meeting with just a portion of a community that will be affected by a development over in my area around Baby Village Mall. Having a meeting that would encompass the entire circumference is almost unmanageable,
right,
if you do it in the virtual sense. And so while planning staff are continuing to meet with them, they're being really clear that some things are going to have to wait because they simply can't provide to the community the type of transparency that they should. They don't have a sense yet of where the community sits on it. And people don't believe that matters to planners, but it really does. And so in some cases, if it's a no-brainer application, you know, sitting on top of a subway station, includes affordable housing, was three-quarters of the way along anyway when COVID struck, then there's a case to be made. Can we finish up the details here? Because then when the Provincial Tribunal Office, the LPAT, opens up, we're ready for a hearing, we've got council direction, and we can go on. But for ones that are a gray area, hadn't appealed yet, we're still working with staff, don't really have a sense of how the community feels about it yet, they're banging on the door saying, can we proceed, can we proceed? But it's been my experience over on the east side that they're saying, we have a lot of work to do yet. And mm-hmm. I can't even get report backs from Solid Waste and Toronto Water as to whether or not your building's viable. So just calm down there, cowboy.
Yeah.
I see that happening if they've evaluated that this is a gray area sort of thing. Because they're doing the development community a favor at that point. If you have a sort of in-between type of development that's not sitting right on top of the subway station, do you really want to build the building that you applied to build when it looked like the economy was just going to keep growing, growing, growing with no end in sight? Or in this new world, do we want to start looking at such things as, I wrote about it just recently to my community, the Density Done Right report that says, maybe those buildings are just too darned expensive to build, and maybe you want to start spreading it out. And the high-rise fixation, maybe COVID-19 is the big reset that says, we have a new economy, let's look at a new way of doing density.
Right, and density is actually a theme that I've been bringing up on this show quite a bit. I've had, my previous episode was The Real Plandemic, which is essentially a relook a rethink of density in planning as a good or a valued aspect of planning. And I'm actually going to have a follow-up show with that on that subject next show. But specific to that, the density report that you mentioned, is it essentially a rethink of density during the pandemic? Density by what's it called again? Sorry, just for I want to link these things down below.
What's interesting is it was written pre-COVID. Density Done Right, which was written by Ryerson's City Building Institute and released just a couple of months before we were all in lockdown, says, yeah, okay, you need 300 units because there's transit nearby. But does it all have to be sitting right on the corner, right by the station?
Right.
Does it really provide you with the range of housing typologies you need? The same 300 units can fit into the neighborhood, and you can have the mid and low rise you wanted on the avenue. If we kind of start to let go our lock on the neighborhood yellow zone and say, is it the end of the world that somebody wanted to take a single family lot and using groundbreaking, environmentally friendly prefab construction build two intertwined homes? Is that the end of the world?
Mm-hmm.
There's a fabulous sample of it in Riverdale right now that is winning decor awards, construction awards, all the rest. And yet it's legal non-compliant. They went through hell to be able to even put the thing in. Maybe that's the wave of the future, because it's gives you more, it gives another family a home without the expense, the gross expense of building these high rises and all the infrastructure that comes with them.
Right. Along with I'm looking forward to reading that report, and I definitely will in preparation for the second pandemic episode. I want to shift ahead just because I know we're time sensitive here. Funding, budgets, I mean, everything's just gone completely out the window. I mean, you touched on it earlier with the police budget. Look at the rethink at the police budget and how much is being dedicated to that. What about intergovernmental cooperation? Is there any, or at what level are the discussions happening with other levels of government in terms of aid or relief or help to cities, especially ones like Toronto, which are tend to be economic engines? Are they being cooperative? Is there no chance that they're coming along with some money? And how are those funding holes going to be bridged, do you think?
I think there is a chance, but it's not just because he's everyone's favorite target. It is time for the premier to get in this conversation, and in a real way. Scotiabank Economics Office did a study just a couple of weeks ago when we were 2 months through the pandemic, and compared provincial spending, not federal spending, and not federal dollars flowed through the province, but what is the province really coughed up? We're behind Newfoundland.
Wow.
We're behind Newfoundland in Ontario. This government has not coughed up really anything unless it directly benefits the business community. Precious little has gone to either additional social services or even additional health care. You may have heard that the premier promised $4 an hour extra to frontline health care workers. Three paychecks have passed Cynthia that, and they haven't received a penny. He's not spending money. So how does he restart our economy? It's real simple. In the GTA and in Ottawa, pay for the transit operation. We need transit dollars now. All of us, from Bonnie Crombie to ourselves, right out to Jim Watson in Ottawa. The major cities of this province that drive its economy have a real problem when the premier returns people to work, because we cannot provide physical distancing unless we have all 100% of our vehicles operating. And when we get to the point where our ridership has recovered to 50%, there will be no physical distancing because we were all overloaded before the pandemic.
Right.
And so the vehicles will be full, they won't be safe, and recovering this economy will be next to impossible. We'll just be into second and third waves. And the federal government has already found it, taken itself into the trillions, and has already provided so much in the way of the personal subsidies, the wage subsidies, the CERB, and so on and so forth, and provided guarantees on infrastructure spending so that the growth of the transit in Ontario and so on and so forth can continue. They've coughed up a lot. And our mayor's tendency is, I'm going to go ask from the path of least resistance. But there comes a point where the, where you can't ask any federal government, and you can't avoid the elephant in the room anymore, a premier who's just not contributing. That's where I'm at. And well, that's the conversation we have to have. We can't cut our budget to take care of $100 million loss a month.
Well, one, I mean, I'm usually very hard on Mayor Tory, just given the milquetoast nature of his policies and the wishy-washiness of his approaches. But it's very obvious, even given that, the premier is very supply-side oriented in his policies. He's always going after the business community in order to spur the economy, quote-unquote, open for business, that type of thing. His approval numbers are way up, so he doesn't have to do a damn thing when it comes to listening to what the city says. And because of this situation,
people don't know how he's letting us down.
And also because there's a rally around the flag.
John Tory needs to begin to voice that the premier is letting us down. It's just, it doesn't make sense for a federal government to provide the operating support for a transit system. It makes total sense for a province to do so. That's why Quebec does. That's why BC does. We cannot go on without that. And we can't keep saying, oh, it's pointless to ask Doug for anything, because he always says no. Because that leaves people thinking Doug's doing a great job. It's time to highlight for people that throughout this crisis, Doug has not done enough.
And not only that, slipping through legislation.
Press conferences are not what we're looking for.
And not only that, slipping through legislation that is actually harming people, like making it easier for people to get evicted. And there was another one I read today, but it's slipping my mind. But at the end of the day, the mayor sitting there shaming people in public parks versus actually spending his time shaming the mayor should maybe rethink his priorities on that. But TTC losing $520 million by Labor Day, even if they were to upload the services, I mean, and take that hit, that is a huge, huge gap to be faced with. And the premier's not going to budge on that by budget time. I don't see it coming. He hasn't voiced any concerns around that. So what happens? The service gets reduced to null? How does that get made up? I'm just that specific one, just because the TTC is kind of near and dear to my heart, and especially since the province is looking to upload the subways, which will cause the TTC to take an even further financial hit, because the subways actually make money in the service regime of transit in Toronto. But how is that being looked at? I can't remember if you're on the TTC board anymore or the commission, but how is that being that specific one being looked at in terms of the whole? Because that's massive.
Well, here's what's interesting. The province discovered that, oh, we don't want this transit system because it costs money to run, and it's got a huge backlog, billions of dollars in backlog, if we want to be proud of what it's running. Mm-hmm. And so they backed away from that. But what's happened is the premier has recast himself in the role of prime minister of transit. He just wants to talk about capital. And that's not fundamentally, that's not what the relationship of a premier ought to be. And I'm not singling him out here, because we had similar failure from the Liberal government. I'm a Liberal, but they didn't come out for us either. Dating all the way back to 1995, we have been missing a fundamental partner to transit day-to-day operations that Quebec has, that Montreal enjoys, that BC has, and Vancouver enjoys it. We're missing it. And so we're growing a system. We now find a different nature to the conversations between Mayor Watson in Ottawa and Mayor Tory in Toronto, because finally, we now have a peer in Ontario. We have another city trying to run rail and finding, hey, this is expensive. I can't do this with property tax. We've known that since 1995 in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And so what's bizarre here is COVID is really providing an opportunity. If you want to blame COVID for the fact that you need to either fund operating transit in Ontario or provide the revenue tool that will provide, we will use any new revenue tool. It's got to be sales tax if you want it to be a big enough amount. But if you gave this city a 1 cent sales tax, they would do it. That post-COVID, exactly what we've always wanted to do with it, use it to fund the operation of the city's transit system, no matter how large it grows, so that property taxes will go back to just providing what property taxes should provide. That won't change. But we have this disruptive moment with COVID-19 that says maybe now is the time we join the rest of the G8 countries of the world, all of whom have major cities who have either an income tax or a sales tax to run a G8 economy's main city's transit system. It's that simple.
So speaking of disruptive moments, I take to heart what you say there, and we all know that the other levels of government have been completely absent in terms of, not completely absent, but absent enough, negligent in when it comes to Toronto's transit system, which essentially is the lifeblood of the economy, gets people moving for a relatively inexpensive cost. But speaking of disruptions, what is going on around the world and the new conversation gaining an incredible amount? I've never thought I'd see the day where the conversation is now shifting really to a defunding of police. And this is not to speak to the abolition of the police, but a defunding, something that every mayor has tried to do in the history of Toronto and has never, ever succeeded, and in fact got steamrolled in many instances, because there's, by the police's argument, there's never a time when you can reduce the police budget. If the crime is up, they want more money. If they're doing a good job, you should reward them with more money. So now the conversation is actually getting some type of academic flight to it. And I, for someone, Councillor Carroll has been on the Police Services Board and has a rich history when it comes to police budgeting and police reform. And if you could speak to that issue a little bit, I'd really appreciate it.
Well, we can play around with their budget forever. During my time, I chaired their budget subcommittee. We flatlined their budget 3 years in a row. We negotiated the lowest contract ever. And we're applauded all over Ontario by other police boards because they got to whipsaw on that. But we didn't change the culture. And we made our big transformational change report, and they did the parts of it they liked, and the rest they just dragged their heels on. That's why no one's wearing a body-worn camera now. And so what the defund movement is about, I'm wonky, and I sometimes don't explain myself. The defund movement hasn't explained themselves very well either. Defund is what it really means is reset. The greatest example of what they're talking about is Camden, where they actually shut down the police service that existed there, the local police service. They actually terminated every single officer and made them reapply for their jobs under a new set of principles. This is the way it's going to run. Apply if you want to work that way or get the hell out. But they really shut it down and reinvented it. So it went from being a municipal force to county force, but the culture change was the key piece. And here's what it did. First of all, between when it started from 2012 to now, violent crime is reduced by 42%, all crime by 70-some%. Graduations have doubled, dropouts have plummeted. All the social determinants of health through investment, but also through just the change in community outlook. When police become guardians, not warriors, has totally changed what was the most crime-ridden, unsafe city in the United States. That's what they're talking about. That type of change is what they're talking about when they say defund the police. And we have to look at that. So we have a motion coming next week that argues about how much should we cut the budget by. That's not going to do it. That's not real defunding. You might as well say cut it by half. Cut it by half and start over. We need to zero base the whole organization and its culture the way you might zero base a budget. Action by action, what are you doing? Does it still need to be done? Why is every mental health a person in mental health crisis, why are they answered by four or five police officers?
Yeah.
Why is the mental, we have mental health crisis intervention teams. They only get to come when it's all over.
Right.
And often it's not, particularly if that person is Black, by the time they get there, that person is dead. I know that there are lots of responses where that's not the case, but defund the police is about changing that as much as it's about money.
Yeah. And some people look at the increased militarization of the police, just in appearance alone, has been an issue, and people look at that as being directly tied to their funding. For me, I look at it as a big issue. I mean, when Mark Saunders, the current outgoing police chief, came on board, the first thing he did is he made all the cop cars look like Batmobiles, and everyone was like, "What are you doing? Why haven't we adopted something like the Battenberg markings, the high visibility markings like they have in Europe?" I mean,
that
could be just even a facile way of changing the outward facing culture of the police force, and maybe perhaps banning the use of bulletproof gear and, you know, hard knuckle shelled gloves when people are just responding to a wellness check. The Battenberg markings thing has always weirded me out. Could you talk to that a little bit, actually?
Well, that was really the first experience that Mark had in the fact that he really can't make any change without going to the board and going to the community.
Mm-hmm.
Those just appeared on the streets
one
day.
Now they're everywhere. Even though he said he was going to stop them.
I was sitting on the board. Yeah, I was sitting on the board and quite engaged in the board when they started. And the first I heard of them was when somebody sent me a picture via Twitter and said, "What the hell is this thing?" And that was the original. The original was truly a ghost car. It really went as far as it could. Well, he had by then already ordered all of these gray mobiles and ordered. And all he could do without spending an absolute fortune was at least upgrade the markings on top of them. And so what you see now is a slightly adjusted version that the board forced. But, you know, the price tag scared even us from abolishing them altogether, just trying to improve upon them. And that's where it became clear to him, I'm not really a police officer anymore. I'm a politician. And I have to look at the politics of things. That's my role, so that the officers can be officers. I'm the one who's supposed to be dealing with the community and the politics of these things and how they play out as we go out into the community. So it's one example of many struggles that happen there. What you're going to see a council starting to grapple with is, you know, we made reports and grandiose gestures about changes. The province did as well, ordering reports for us and commissions. And what we get from police officers is a tracking for a year or two after a report comes out. And post Andrew Loku, there was a report. Post Sammy Yateen, there was a report. And we get reports ticking a box, implemented, implementation ongoing. But that's open to the interpretation of how officers actually go about it. And you look back a couple of years later, hasn't been implemented at all.
Yeah.
There's no real change.
No real change.
And so we have to really disrupt the drivers. We have to do away with the notion that the real arbiter of culture in the police force is not going to be the chief. It's always going to be the police union boss.
Yeah. So speaking of him, McCormick.
That has to change. And in the... Yeah, I'm not his favorite person. If he sees his podcast, he'll come out to attack me. But there are real officers out there who would rather not be in this angry politics, who do the job they do well in their communities because they set aside the ugly parts of the culture and they don't use them.
Yeah.
And as a result, they do a fantastic job. And those are the officers that I want to make. I want to make a perfect service for them to be working in.
So speaking to the angry culture, the angry politics around policing, yeah. We saw a photo, I believe, of Mark Saunders kneeling at one of the protests or one of the rallies. And then a few days later, we see him announce an early retirement. Is what precipitated that in your mind? I mean, you don't have any inside info, always appreciated, but I mean, just in your head, what first went through your mind when the police chief stepped down from his position yesterday, I believe?
Oh, well, knowing him as I do, knowing him back at the time when he and his wife were going through their kidney transplant, my first worry was his health. And later I watched the whole announcement and he said his health is not the issue. But I have no reason to believe that it isn't a lot about just having had enough and wanting to be with family. You know, we're all trying to relate it to COVID, but in fact, what you can relate it to is the point in time late last year, the police board deliberated for a long time and then decided to renew his contract just for another 2 years and to reconsider then, as opposed to just giving him an automatic five. There's no doubt that that gives a person pause and says, do I want to stick around and battle for this? Or have I really, you know, have I really done enough in my 37 years? Mm-hmm. And as soon as you start to go down that road and start to think about that, retirement starts to look pretty attractive. He's gotten them through the main part of COVID-19. Unfortunately, he probably had made this decision about retirement prior to the death of George Floyd and the incidents we still don't know about surrounding Regis Korchinski packet here in the city of Toronto.
Right.
If you think about it, that was only a couple of weeks ago, and these decisions take a month or two.
And for the people watching,
you know, I don't want to blame.
Sorry, yeah. Go ahead. For the people watching, she's the woman who fell to her death under circumstances still being investigated over in the High Park area, if I believe. Sorry, I just wanted to let people know.
Yeah. It's unfortunate that those incidents have happened back to back. And so he now leaves in the middle of that. But I can honestly say that this is probably a decision that he took a long time with from the point of that 5-year review.
Yeah, that was my sentiment. That was my thoughts already. Yeah. I was just thinking about, you know, his leadership over the last few years and understanding what kind of S show he's going into right now, juggling the politics of policing during a pandemic, and basically said, you know what, maybe someone with more energy, with a fresh outlook, might be better suited for this, and appreciate that he might have had that sober understanding. So in terms of policing, who's in the running, would you suspect? I mean, Peter Slowly competed with him for that job to begin with, but now he's in Ottawa. He just took that position in Ottawa. And that was my thought initially, because he does have more of a reforming mindset. But I wonder if any other candidates might be in the running, do you think?
Well, here's the thing. What really hurt the selection process last time was too much campaigning and speculation about who it should be from in Toronto. And we hired Mark in the end. There were some disappointed candidates. But that whole conversation, focusing on the names we know from within, I think really hurt the process of looking without. This is a lot of public money for starters, but the stakes are so high in so many other ways that this search has to be global.
Yeah.
And so I hope to God that this time we don't limit ourselves to who are the deputy chiefs and it's got to be one of them. So let's start eliminating like we're on you know, House Hunting International or something. This is too important for that. So sure, let's look at the people who are in our police division, but there's so many more people to look at. So
right.
many more people to look at in Canada and beyond. And there, you know, we have so often insisted in Toronto, we get very egotistical and say, well, how could anybody possibly understand the city of Toronto? Like, it just can't be done if you come right. from outside. Oh my God, this will never work. Joe Panicetti was a damn good CFO and city manager for a lot of years, came mm-hmm. from outside.
Right.
And took over the reins of a $2 billion or $13 billion corporation. The same can be true of policing. Some things are unique to Toronto, but maybe not all of them are good. So let's look at the whole field this time and not start this one name campaign. In the end, what we learned is that hurts that person.
I understand.
That and, one name campaign really hurts that person.
Being yeah. on the police services board, it's not always just about selecting the right candidate. It's also about the cultural inertia within the force itself. I mean, in the past, you know, yeah. police services board members had smear pieces appear in the press about them. They've had their phones wiretapped. I mean, just awful, awful mm-hmm. behavior. I mean, I don't know if it's the police union or people individuals within the police force or police service that conducted that. Your time on the police services board, did you experience any of that, or did that culture completely go away over a decade ago?
Nope, I've experienced it. I'm not going to get into details, but I experienced it. I didn't take it to the media, but I definitely took it to the chief, to the mayor, and to the chair.
So
that
when you,
happens.
So when you have
I called it out.
Yeah.
I called it out to make it stop. I made them all understand that there was only so much of it I was going to put up with, and I would go to the media. So it stopped.
In terms of not going into details, was it more physical or was it more electronic surveillance, that kind of thing? Was it on a surveilling level?
It affected my family.
Oh.
It affected my family. It affected my family. And that's the only reason I didn't go to the media, because at that point it has to be their decision. But my family was impacted, and I made it very clear at the decision, at the division that seemed to be responsible in the boardroom and to the chief, that it better not ever happen again.
That is scary, awful, and I'm not trying to be hyperbolic here, but that sounds like organized crime level stuff. And I the fact that it's still potentially going on, and people with not, and maybe counselors with not as much fortitude as you have, are probably still being subjected to it. It makes it a scary place. And what are the chances, do you think, a complete rebuild of the Toronto Police Service would be, considering that maybe today's energy around reforming the police sustains and builds over the next few months? What do you think the chances that we could get a complete rebuild happening are?
They're huge right now. They're huge. You know, I worked with Mark. I have great respect for Mark, and he may even made this part of his decision that in this day, in this week, we needed to hear this. You know, we need to go beyond just the fiddling around the edges type of change. And now is really the time to do it. We're at a point right now where the kinds of gamesmanship that go on inside the service leadership, more than the rank and file, but inside the service leadership and the board politics, the resistance to change really isn't going to fly anymore. This is a new community. Everyone has been saying this around the globe. The difference here, this is not a Black Lives Matter march alone anymore. This is a humanity march. Humanity is saying mm-hmm. policing has to change. And I think it has to start in the biggest, largest, spikiest cities with the biggest, most power-mad services. We have to make huge change. And it's being signaled all over the world. And if we fancy ourselves a world-class city, this is how we're going to be measured. What are the changes we're going to make right now?
Yeah.
Real change. Not trimming, not tweaking.
And
new leadership will have to be hired on that basis.
Yeah, and what a great note to round off the show. I know we're kind of strapped for time a little bit, and I've taken a lot more of your time than perhaps I deserve, but I really appreciate you coming on. Could you let us know what you see the city of Toronto and city council looking like a year from now, just to end off the program? Maybe give us a little bit of hope, other than it being a transformative moment in our history. You know, people are always looking for some hopeful ideas.
Well, I do have hope. I have hope. A lot of people have signaled the change they want, and they're not going to forget about it soon. And so a year from now, it'll be mid-2021, and people will start talking about the leadership change potential, the whole spirit of the city changing and growing out of COVID-19 being signaled by the election that's coming. In 2022, all three levels of government could be going into an election, and people will have lived through the biggest experience in a century, and it will color what they're looking for at every level of government. I'm really excited about that. We have to stand for change or get out of the way.
I really appreciate that sentiment, and I agree wholeheartedly, and especially, and hopefully by the time the elections roll around, we'll have figured this COVID thing out and people can actually go and vote in person, because as we see south of the border,
yes,
even that's becoming political, and there's all kinds of weird, uncalculable energies happening around how and where people vote and when. Counselor, I really appreciate you coming on. I would love to have you on again in the future if you would come on and grace us with your presence, because it's been fascinating. And I'm sure a lot of the listeners, even just some of the questions I've been fielding over the last little while when I mentioned I was having a city councilor on, you've touched on a lot of those, and I really appreciate you coming on our program. I really would love to have you on again, so please promise us that next time I ask, I'll have you on. You've been a great guest, and thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Anytime for the six.
Perfect.
Okay. Thanks, Rob.
No problem. Thank you. So, everyone, thank you for tuning in. This has been a great cast. The next cast, we're going to be talking about city planning in the pandemic sphere and how ideas around that are changing. It's going to be an excellent show. Again, I want to thank Councillor Carroll for coming on. And if you have any questions or concerns, make sure you get in touch with us. info@pod6.com. That's info@pod6ix.com. If you have any ideas for guests or subjects, that's all welcome there too. Please subscribe to the audio version of this podcast by looking for Lockdown Toronto in whatever podcatcher you use, except Apple Podcasts. I haven't gotten that one yet. I'm not a big fan of Apple, so you'll have to wait a little while for that. But thanks for tuning in, and we will see you in the next one. Appreciate it.